It by Stephen King, continuing on page 971. He stared at the underbrush, at the path twisting away through it and back toward Kansas Street, and felt his mind suddenly go up another notch, as if to a higher plane. There was no stuttering in his mind. He felt as if his thoughts had been borne away on a mad flow of intuition, as if everything were coming to him. George at one end, me and my friends at the other. And then it will stop. Again. Again, yes, again, because this has happened before, and there always has to be some sacrifice at the end, some terrible thing to stop it. I don't know how I can know that, but I do, and they let it happen, Bill muttered, staring wide-eyed at the ratty pigtail of path. Sure they did-a-do. Bill? Bev asked, pleading. Stan stood on one side of her, small and neat, in a blue polo shirt and chinos. Mike stood on the other, looking at Bill intensely, as if reading his thoughts. They let it happen. They always do. And things quiet down. Things go on. It sleeps. Sleeps, or hibernates like a bear. And then it starts again, and they know. People know. They know it has to be, so it can be. I la la la. Oh, please God, oh, please God, he thrusts his fists, please God, against the posts. Let me get this out, the posts, and still insists, oh God, oh Christ, oh please, let me be able to talk. I led you down here, because no place is safe, Bill said. Spittle blabbered from his lips. He wiped them with the back of one hand. The dairy is it. Do you understand me? He glared at them. They drew away a little, their eyes shiny, almost thanatropic with fright. The hairy is it. Any place we go. When it gets us, they won't see. They won't ha-ha here. They won't no. He looked at them, pleading. Don't you see how it is? All we can do is to try and finish what we started. Beverly saw Mr. Ross getting up, looking at her, folding his paper, and simply going into his house. They won't see. They won't hear. They won't know. And my father. Take those pants off, slut child. Had meant to kill her. Mike thought of lunch with Bill. Bill's mother had been off in her own dreamy world, seeming not to see either of them, reading a Henry James novel while the boys made sandwiches and gobbled them standing at the counter. Richie thought of Stan's neat but utterly empty house. Stan had been a little surprised. His mother was almost always home at lunchtime. On the few occasions when she wasn't, she left a note saying where she could be reached. But there had been no note today. The car was gone, and that was all. Probably went shopping with her friend Debbie, Stan said, frowning a little, and had set to work making egg salad sandwiches. Richie had forgotten about it, until now. Eddie thought of his mother. When he had gone out with his Parcheesi board, there had been none of the usual cautions. Be careful, Eddie. Get under cover if it rains. Eddie, don't you dare play any rough games, Eddie. She hadn't asked if he had his aspirator, hadn't told him what time to be home, hadn't warned him against those rough boys you play with. She had simply gone on watching her soap opera story on TV as if he didn't exist. As if he didn't exist. A version of the same thought went through all of the boys' minds. They had, at some point between getting up this morning and lunchtime, simply become ghosts. Ghosts. Bill, Stan said harshly, if we cut across, through the old cape? Bill shook his head. I don't think so. We'd get caught in the bam bababoo, the quick mud. Or there'd be real piranha fish in the Kanduskeeg, or something else. Each had his or her own different vision of the same end. Ben saw bushes which suddenly became man-eating plants. Beverly saw flying leeches like the ones that had come out of that old refrigerator. Stan saw the mucky ground and the bamboo vomiting up the living corpses of children caught in there by the fabled quick mud. Mike Hanlon imagined small Jurassic reptiles with horrid saw teeth suddenly boiling out of the cleft of a rotten tree, attacking them, biting them to pieces. Richie saw the crawling eye oozing down on top of them as they ran under the railroad trestle. And Eddie saw them climbing the old Cape embankment, only to look up and see the leper standing at the top, his sagging flesh acrawl with beetles and maggots waiting for them. "If we could get out of town somehow," Richie muttered. Then winced as thunder shouted a furious negative from the sky. More rain fell. It was still only squalling, but soon it would begin to come down seriously in sheets and torrents. The day's hazy peace was now utterly gone, as if it had never been at all. "We'd be safe if we could just get out of this fucking town." Beverly began, "Beep, beep," and then a rock came flying out of the shaggy bushes and struck Mike on the side of the head. He staggered backward, blood flowing through the tight cap of his hair, and would have fallen if Bill hadn't caught him. "Teach you to throw rocks?" Henry's voice floated mockingly to them. Bill could see the others looking around, wild-eyed, ready to bolt in six different directions. And if they did that, it would really be over. "Ben," he said sharply. Ben looked at him. "Bill, we gotta run. They..." Two more rocks flew out of the bushes. One struck Stan on the upper thigh. He yelled, more surprised than hurt. Beverly sidestepped the second. It struck the ground and rolled through the clubhouse trap door.
"Do you remember the first day you came down here?"
Bill shouted over the thunder.
The day who let out?"
"Bill!" Richie shouted. Bill thrust a shushing hand at him. His eyes remained fixed on Ben, pinning him to the spot.
"Sure," Ben said, miserably trying to look in all directions at once.
The bushes were now wavering and dancing wildly, their motion nearly tidal.
"The drain," Bill said. "The pumping station. That's where we're supposed to go.
Take us there."
"But take us to there."
A fusillade of rocks whizzed out of the bushes, and for a moment Bill saw Victor Chris's face, somehow frightened, drugged, and avid all at the same time. Then a rock smashed into his cheekbone, and it was Mike's turn to keep Bill from falling down. For a moment, he couldn't see straight. His cheek felt numb. Then sensation returned in painful throbs, and he felt blood running down his face. He swiped at his cheek, wincing at the painful knob that was rising there, looked at the blood, wiped it on his jeans. His hair whipped wildly in the freshening wind.
"Teach you to throw rocks, you stuttering asshole,"
Henry half laughed, half screamed.
"Take us," Bill yelled.
He understood now why he had sent Eddie back to get Ben. It was that pumping station they were supposed to go to,
that very one,
and only Ben knew exactly which one it was. They ran along both banks of the Kandusky at irregular intervals.
"It hits the Plaplahase, the way in, the way to it."
"Bill, you can't know that," Beverly cried. He shouted furiously at her, at all of them.
"I know."
Ben stood there for a moment, wetting his lips, looking at Bill. Then he struck off across the clearing, heading toward the river. A brilliant bolt of lightning streaked across the sky, purplish-white, followed by a rip of thunder that made Bill reel on his feet. A fist-sized chunk of rock sailed past his nose and struck Ben's buttocks. He yipped with pain, and his hand went to the spot.
"Yeah, fat boy," Henry cried in that same half-laughing, half-screaming voice.
The bushes rustled and crashed, and Henry appeared as the rain stopped fooling around and came in a downpour. Water ran in Henry's crew cut, in his eyebrows, down his cheeks. His grin showed all his teeth.
"Teach you to throw rock."
Mike had found one of the pieces of scrap wood left over from building the clubhouse roof, and now he threw it. It flipped over twice and struck Henry's forehead. He screamed, clapped one hand to the spot like a man who's just had one hell of a good idea, and sat down hard.
"Run," Bill hollered. "After Ben."
More crashings and stumblings in the bushes, and as the rest of the losers ran after Ben Hanscom, Victor and Belch appeared. Henry stood up, and the three of them gave chase. Even later, when the rest of that day had come back to Ben, he recalled only jumbled images of their run through the bushes. He remembered branches overloaded with dripping leaves slapping against his face, dousing him with cold water. He remembered that the thunder and lightning seemed to have become almost constant. And he remembered that Henry's screams for them to come back and fight seemed to merge with the sound of the Kanduskeag as they drew closer to it. Every time he slowed, Bill would whack him on the back to make him hurry up.
What if I can't find it? What if I can't find that particular pumping station?
The breath tore in and out of his lungs, hot and bloody tasting in the back of his throat. A stitch was sinking into his side. His buttocks sang where the rock had hit him. Beverly had said Henry and his friends meant to kill them, and Ben believed it now. Yes, he did. He came to the Kanduskeag's bank so suddenly that he nearly plunged over the edge. He managed to get his balance, and then the embankment, undercut by the spring runoff, collapsed, and he went tumbling over anyway, skidding all the way to the edge of the fast-running water, his shirt rucking up in the back, clayey mud streaking and sticking to his skin. Bill piled into him and yanked him to his feet. The others burst out of the bushes, which overhung the bank, one after the other. Richie and Eddie were last, Richie with one arm slung around Eddie's waist, his dripping specks clinging precariously to the end of his nose.
Where?
Bill shouted. Ben looked first left and then right, aware that the time was suicidally short. The river seemed higher already, and the rain-dark sky had given it a dangerous slate-gray color as it boiled its way along. Its banks were choked with underbrush and stunted trees, all of them now dancing to the wind's tune. He could hear Eddie sobbing for breath.
Where?
I don't know,
he began. And then he saw the leaning tree and the eroded cave beneath it. That was where he had hidden that first day. He had dozed off, and when he woke up, he had heard Bill and Eddie goofing around. Then the big boys had come. Seen. Conquered.
Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me.
There, he shouted. That way.
Lightning flashed again, and this time Ben could hear it. A buzzing noise like an overloaded Lionel train transformer. It struck the tree, and blue-white electric fire sizzled its gnarly base into splinters and toothpicks sized for a fairy tale giant. It fell toward the river with a rending crash, driving spray high into the air. Ben drew in a dismayed gasp and smelled something hot and punky and wild. A fireball rolled up the bole of the downed tree, seemed to flash brighter, and went out. Thunder exploded, not above them, but around them, as if they stood in the center of the thunderclap. The rain sheeted down. Bill thumped him on the back, awaking him from his dazed contemplation of these things.
Go!
Ben went, splashing and stumbling along the verge of the river, his hair hanging in his eyes. He reached the tree. The little root cave beneath it had been obliterated, and climbed over it, digging his toes into its wet hide, scraping his hands and forearms. Bill and Richie manhandled Eddie over, and as he stumbled off the tree trunk, Ben caught him. They both went tumbling to the ground. Eddie cried out.
You all right?
Ben shouted.
I guess so,
Eddie shouted back, getting to his feet. He fumbled for his aspirator and almost dropped it. Ben grabbed it for him, and Eddie gave him a grateful look as he stuffed it into his mouth and triggered it. Richie came over, then Stan and Mike. Bill boosted Beverly up onto the tree, and Ben and Richie caught her coming down on the far side, her hair plastered to her head, her blue jeans now black. Bill came last, pulling himself onto the trunk and swinging his legs around. He saw Henry and the other two splashing down the river toward them, and as he slid off the fallen tree, he shouted, "River rocks! Throw rocks!" There were plenty of them here on the bank, and the lightning-struck tree made a perfect barricade. In a moment or two, all seven of them were chucking rocks at Henry and his pals. They had nearly reached the tree. The range was point-blank. They were driven back, yelling with pain and fury, as rocks struck their faces, their chests, their arms and legs.
"Teach us to throw rocks," Richie shouted, and chucked one the size of a hen's egg at Victor.
It struck his shoulder and bounced almost straight up into the air. Victor howled.
I say, go on and teach us, boy. We learn good.
"Yeah," Mike screamed. How do you like it?
The answer was not much. They retreated until they were out of range and huddled together. A moment later, they climbed the bank, slipping and stumbling on the slick, wet earth, which was already honeycombed with little running streamlets holding onto branches to stay upright. They disappeared into the underbrush.
"They're going to go around us, Big Bill," Richie said, pushing his glasses up on his nose.
"That's okay," Bill said. Go on, Ben. We'll follow you.
Ben trotted along the embankment, paused, expecting that Henry and the others would burst out into his face at any moment, and saw the pumping station 20 yards farther down the stream bed. The others followed him to it. They could see other cylinders on the opposite bank, one fairly close, the other 40 yards upstream.
Those two were both shooting torrents of muddy water into the Kenduskeag, but only a trickle was coming from the pipe sticking out of the embankment below this one. It wasn't humming either, Ben noticed. The pumping machinery had broken down. He looked at Bill thoughtfully and with some fright. Bill was looking at Richie, Stan, and Mike.
Well, we had to get the lid off, he said. Help me.
There were handholds in the iron, but the rain had made them slippery and the lid itself was incredibly heavy. Ben moved in next to Bill, and Bill shifted his hands a little to make room. Ben could hear water dripping inside, an echoey, unpleasant sound, like water dripping into a well.
Now,
Bill shouted, and the five of them heaved in unison. The lid moved with an ugly grating sound. Beverly grabbed on beside Richie, and Eddie pushed with his good arm.
One, two, three, push,
Richie chanted. The lid grated a little farther off the top of the cylinder. Now a crescent of darkness showed.
One, two, three, push.
The crescent fattened.
One, two, three, push.
Ben shoved until red spots danced in front of his eyes.
Stand back, Mike shouted. There it goes, there it goes.
They stood away and watched as the big circular cap overbalanced, then fell. It dug a slash in the wet earth and landed upside down like an oversized checker. Beetles scurried off its surface and into the matted grass.
Uck, Eddie said.
Bill peered inside. Iron rungs descended to a circular pool of black water, its surface now pocked with raindrops. The silent pump brooded in the middle of this, half submerged. He could see water flowing into the pumping station from the mouth of its inflow pipe, and with a sinking in his guts, he thought,
that's where we have to go, in there.
Eddie, grab onto me. Eddie looked at him, uncomprehending.
Like a piggerback. Hold on with your good arm,
he demonstrated. Eddie understood, but was reluctant.
Quick, Bill snapped. They'll be here.
Eddie grabbed on around Bill's neck. Stan and Mike boosted him up so he could hook his legs around Bill's midsection. As Bill swung clumsily over the lip of the cylinder, Ben saw that Eddie's eyes were tightly shut. Over the rain, he could hear another sound. Whipping branches, snapping twigs, voices. Henry, Victor, and Belch. The world's ugliest cavalry charge. Bill gripped the rough concrete lip of the cylinder and felt his way down, step by careful step. The iron rungs were slippery. Eddie had him in what was almost a death grip, and Bill supposed he was getting a pretty graphic demonstration of what Eddie's asthma was really all about.
I'm scared, Bill, Eddie whispered. I am too.
He let go of the concrete rim and grabbed the topmost rung. Although Eddie was nearly choking him and felt as if he had already gained 40 pounds, Bill paused a moment, looking at the barrens, the Kenduskeag, the racing clouds. A voice inside, not a frightened voice, just a firm one, had told him to take a good look in case he never saw the upper world again. So he looked, then began to descend with Eddie clinging to his back.
I can't hold on much longer, Eddie managed.
You won't have to, Bill said. We're almost down. One of his feet went into chilly water. He felt for the next rung and found it. There was another below that, and then the ladder ended. He was standing in knee-deep water beside the pump. He squatted, wincing as the cold water soaked his pants, and let Eddie off. He drew a deep breath. The smell wasn't so hot, but it was great not to have Eddie's arm wrapped around his throat. He looked up at the cylinder's mouth. It was about 10 feet over his head. The others were grouped around the rim, looking down.
Come on, he shouted. Well, one at a time. Be quick.
Beverly came first, swinging easily over the rim and grabbing the ladder, and Stan next. The others followed. Richie came last, pausing to listen to the progress of Henry and friends. He thought, from the sound of their blundering progress, that they would probably pass a little to the left of this pumping station, but almost certainly not by enough to make a difference. At that moment, Victor bellowed,
Henry, there, Tozier.
Richie looked around and saw them rushing toward him. Victor was in the lead, and then Henry pushed him aside so savagely that Victor skidded to his knees. Henry had a knife all right, a regular pig sticker. Drops of water were falling from the blade. Richie glanced into the cylinder, saw Ben and Stan helping Mike off the ladder, and swung over himself. Henry understood what he was doing and screamed at him. Richie, laughing crazily, slammed his left hand in the crook of his right elbow and stuck his forearm skyward. His hand fisted in what may be the world's oldest gesture. To be sure, Henry got the point. He popped his middle finger up.
You'll die down there,
Henry shouted.
Prove it,
Richie shouted, laughing. He was terrified of going into this concrete throat, but he still couldn't stop laughing. And in his Irish cop's voice, he bugled,
Sure and begorra, the luck of the Irish never runs out, me fine lad.
Henry slipped on the wet grass and went sprawling on his butt less than 20 feet from where Richie stood. His feet on the top rung of the ladder bolted to the inner curve of the pumping station, his head and chest out.
Hey, banana heels,
Richie shouted, delirious with triumph, and then scooted down the ladder. The iron rungs were slick, and once he almost fell. Then Bill and Mike grabbed him, and he was standing up to his knees in water with the rest of them in a loose circle around the pump. He was trembling all over. He felt hot and cold chills chasing each other up his back, and still he couldn't stop laughing.
You should have seen him, Big Bill, clumsy as ever, still can't get out of his own frock and way.
Henry's head appeared in the circular opening at the top. Scratches from branches and brambles crisscrossed his cheeks. His mouth was working, and his eyes blazed.
Okay,
he shouted down at them. His words had a flat resonance inside the concrete cylinder, not quite an echo.
Here I come, got you now.
He swung one leg over, felt for the topmost rung with his foot, found it, swung the other one over. Speaking loud, Bill said,
Well, when he gets to the down close enough, will we all grab him, pull him to the down, duck him under. Got it?
Righto, Governor,
Richie said, and snapped a salute with one trembling hand.
Got you, Ben said.
Stan tipped a wink at Eddie, who didn't understand what was going on, except it seemed to him that Richie had gone crazy. He was laughing like a loon while Henry Bowers, the dreaded Henry Bowers, prepared to come down and kill them all like rats in a rain barrel.
All ready for him, Bill, Stan cried.
Henry froze three rungs down. He looked down at the losers over his shoulder. His face seemed, for the first time, doubtful. Eddie suddenly got it. If they came down, they would have to come one at a time. It was too high to jump, especially with the pumping machinery to land on, and here they were, the seven of them, waiting in a tight little circle.
Cuckahumma on, huh, Henry?
Bill said pleasantly. Well,
what are you waiting for?
That's right, Richie chimed in. You like to beat up little kids, right? Come on, Henry.
We're waiting, Henry, Bev said sweetly. I don't think you'll like it when you get down here, but come on if you want to.
Unless you're chicken, Ben added.
He began to make chicken sounds. Richie joined him at once, and soon all of them were doing it. The derisive clucking rebounded between the damp, trickling walls. Henry looked down at them, the knife clutched in his left hand, his face the color of old bricks. He put up with perhaps 30 seconds of it, and then climbed out again. The losers sent up catcalls and insults.
Okay, Bill said. He spoke in a lower voice. Well, we got to get into that drain, quick.
Why?
Beverly asked. But Bill was spared the effort of an answer. Henry reappeared at the rim of the pumping station and dropped a rock the size of a soccer ball into the pipe. Beverly screamed, and Stan pulled Eddie against the circular wall with a hoarse yell. The rock struck the pumping machinery's rusty housing and produced a musical bong. It ricocheted left and struck the concrete wall, missing Eddie by less than half a foot. A chip of the concrete flicked painfully against his cheek. The rock fell into the water with a splash.
Quick,
Bill shouted again, and they crowded around the pumping station's inflow pipe. Its bore was about 5 feet in diameter. Bill sent them in one after another. A vague circus image, all the big clowns coming out of the little car, passed across his consciousness in a meteoric flash. Years later, he would use the same image in a book called The Black Rapids, and climbed in last, after ducking another rock. As they watched, more rocks flew down, most striking the pump housing and rebounding at crazy angles. When they stopped falling, Bill looked out and saw Henry coming down the ladder again, as quick as he could.
Get him, he shouted to the others.
Richie, Ben, and Mike floundered out behind Bill. Richie leaped high and grabbed Henry's ankle. Henry cursed and shook his leg as if trying to kick away a small dog with big teeth. A terrier, perhaps, or a Pekingese. Richie grabbed a rung, scrambled up even higher, and actually did manage to sink his teeth into Henry's ankle. Henry screamed and pulled himself up quickly. One of his loafers came off and splashed into the water, where it sank with no ado at all.
Bit me,
Henry was screaming.
Bit me, cocksucker, bit me.
Yeah, good thing I had a tetanus shot this spring,
Richie flung at him.
Bash them, Henry was raving. Bash them, bomb them back to the Stone Age. Bash their brains in.
More rocks flew. The boys backed into the drain again quickly. Mike was struck in the arm by a small rock, and he held it tight, wincing, until the pain began to abate.
It's a standoff, Ben said. They can't get down, and we can't get up.
We're not supposed to get up, Bill said quietly.
And you all know it. Well, we're not ever supposed to get up again.
They looked at him, their eyes hurt and afraid. No one said anything. Henry's voice, fury masquerading as mockery, floated down.
We can wait up here all day, you guys.
Beverly had turned away and was looking back along the bore of the inflow pipe. The light grew diffuse quickly, and she could not see much. What she could see was a concrete tunnel, its lower third filled with rushing water. It was higher on her now than it had been when they first squeezed in here, she realized.
That would be because this pump wasn't working and only some of the water was exiting on the Kanduskeag side.
She felt claustrophobia touch her throat, turning the skin there to something that felt like flannel. If the water rose enough, they would drown.
Bill, do we have to?
He shrugged. It said everything. Yeah, they had to. What else was there? Be killed by Henry, Victor, and Belch and the Barons? Or by something else, maybe something worse, in town? She understood his thought well enough now. There was no stutter in his shrug. Better for them to go to it. Have it out, like the showdown in a Western movie. Cleaner, braver.
Richie said, What was that ritual you told us about, Big Bill? The one in the library book.
Ch-ch-chud, Bill said, smiling a little.
Chud, Richie nodded. You bite its tongue and it bites yours, right?
Right.
Then you tell jokes.
Bill nodded.
Funny, Richie said, looking into the dark pipe. I can't think of a single one.
Me either, Ben said.
The fear was heavy in his chest, almost suffocating. He felt that the only thing keeping him from just sitting down in the water and blubbering like a baby, or just going crazy, was Bill's calm, sure presence. And Beverly. He felt he would rather dive and show Beverly how afraid he was.
Do you know where this pipe goes? Stan asked Bill.
Bill shook his head.
Do you know how to find it?
Bill shook his head again. We'll know when we're getting close, Richie said suddenly. He drew a deep, trembling breath.
If we have to do it, then let's go.
Bill nodded.
I'll be first, then Eddie.
Ben, Bev,
Stahan the man, Mike.
You last, Richie.
Everyone keep one hand on the shoulder of the person in front of you. It's going to be the dark.
You coming out?
Henry Bowers shrieked down at them.
We're going to come out somewhere, Richie muttered, I guess.
They formed up like a procession of blind men. Bill looked back once, confirming that each had a hand on the shoulder of the person ahead. Then, bending forward slightly against the rush of the current, Bill Dendro led his friends into the dark where the boat he had made for his brother had gone almost a year before. Chapter 20. The Circle Closes. 1. Tom. Tom Rogan was having one fuck of a crazy dream. In it, he was killing his father. Part of his mind understood how crazy this was. His father had died when Tom was only in the third grade. Well, maybe died wasn't such a good word. Maybe committed suicide was actually the truth. Ralph Rogan had made himself a gin and lie cocktail. One for the road, you might say. Tom had been put in nominal charge of his brother and sisters, and he began to receive weapons if anything went wrong with them. So he couldn't have killed his father. Except there he was, in this frightening dream, holding what looked like a harmless handle of some sort to his father's neck. Only it wasn't really harmless, was it? There was a button in the end of the handle, and if he pushed it, a blade would pop out and go right through his father's neck.
I'm not going to do anything like that, Daddy. Don't worry, his dreaming mind thought just before his finger jammed down on the button and the blade popped out.
His father's sleeping eyes opened and stared up at the ceiling. His father's mouth opened and a bloody, gargling sound came out.
Daddy, I didn't do it, his mind screamed. Someone else.
He struggled to wake up and couldn't. The best he could do, and it turned out to be not very good at all, was to fade into a new dream. In this one, he was splashing and slogging his way down a long, dark tunnel.
His balls hurt and his face stung because it was crisscrossed with scratches. There were others with him, but he could only make out vague shapes. It didn't matter anyway. What mattered were the kids somewhere up ahead. They needed to pay. They needed a weapon to be punished. Whatever purgatory this was, it was a smelly one. Water dripped and echoed. His shoes and pants were soaked. The little shitpots were somewhere up ahead in this maze of tunnels, and perhaps they thought Henry, Tom, and his friends would get lost, but the joke was on them. Ha ha, all over you. Because he had another friend, oh yes, a special friend, and this friend had marked the path they were to take with moon balloons. Thingamajigs that were big and round and somehow lighted from within so that they shed a glow like that which falls mysteriously from old-fashioned street lamps. One of these balloons floated and drifted at each intersection, and on the side of each was an arrow pointing the way into the tunnel branch he and Belch and Victor, his unseen friends, were to take. And it was the right path, oh yes. He could hear the others ahead, their splashing progress echoing back, the distorted murmurs of their voices. They were getting closer, catching up. And when they did, Tom looked down and saw that he still had the switch knife in his hand. For a moment, he was frightened. This was like one of those crazy astral experiences he sometimes read about in the weekly tabloids, when your spirit left your body and entered someone else's. The shape of his body felt different to him, as if he were not Tom, but Henry. Someone else, someone younger. He began to fight his way out of the dream, panicked. And then a voice was talking to him, a soothing voice whispering in his ear. It doesn't matter when this is, and it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is that Beverly is up there. She's with them, my good friend. And you know what? She's been doing something one hell of a lot worse than sneaking smokes. You know what? She's been fucking her old friend Bill Denbrough. Yes, indeed. She and that stuttering freak going right at it. They... That's a lie, he tried to scream. She wouldn't dare. But he knew it was no lie. She had used a belt on his kick me in the balls and run off, and she now had cheated on him, the slutty child. Little round heels bitch had actually cheated on him. And oh, dear friends, oh, good neighbors, she was going to get the weapon of all weapons. First her, and then Denbrough, her novel-writing friend. And anyone who tried to get in his way, you could count them in for a piece of the action, too. He stepped up his pace, although the breath was already whistling in and out of his throat. Up ahead, he could see another luminous circle bobbing in the darkness, another moon balloon. He could hear the voices of the people ahead of him, and the fact that they were childish voices no longer bothered him. It was as the voice said. It didn't matter where, when, or who. Beverly was up there. And oh, dear friends, oh, good neighbors. Come on, you guys, move your asses, he said. And it didn't even matter that his voice wasn't his own, but the voice of a boy. Then, as they approached the moon balloon, he looked around and saw his companions for the first time. Both of them were dead. One was headless. The face of the other had been split open as if by a great talon. We're moving as fast as we can, Henry, the boy with the split face said, and his lips moved in two pieces, grotesquely out of sync with each other. And that was when Tom shrieked the dream to pieces and came back to himself, tottering on the brink of what felt like some great empty space. He struggled to keep his balance, lost it, and tumbled to the floor. The floor was carpeted, but the fall still sent a sickening burst of pain through his hurt knee, and he stifled another cry against his forearm. Where am I? Where the fuck am I? He became aware of a faint but clear white light, and for a frightening moment, he thought he was back in the dream again, that it was light cast by one of those crazy balloons. Then he remembered leaving the bathroom door partially open and the fluorescent light in there on. He always left the light on when staying in a strange place. It saved you barking your shins if you had to get up in the night to pee. That clicked reality into place. It had been a dream, all some crazy dream. He was in a Holiday Inn. This was Derry, Maine. He had chased his wife here, and in the middle of a crazy nightmare, he had fallen out of bed. That was all. That was the long and the short of it. That wasn't just a nightmare. He jumped as if the words had been spoken beside his ear instead of inside his own mind. It didn't seem like his own interior voice at all. It was cold, alien, but somehow hypnotic and believable. He got up slowly, fumbled a glass of water off the table beside the bed, and drank it down. He ran shaky hands through his hair. The clock on the table said 3:10. Go back to sleep. Wait until morning. That alien voice answered.
But there will be people around in the morning, too many people. And besides, you can beat them down there this time. This time you can be first. Down there?
He thought of his dream, the water, the dripping dark. The light suddenly seemed brighter. He turned his head, not wanting to, but helpless to stop. A groan slipped out of his mouth. A balloon was tied to the knob of the bathroom door. It floated at the end of a string about 3 feet long. The balloon glowed, full of a ghostly white light. It looked like a will-o'-the-wisp glimpsed in a swamp, floating dreamily between trees overhung with gray ropes of moss. An arrow was printed on the balloon's gently bulging skin, an arrow that was blood scarlet. It was pointing at the door leading out into the hall.
It doesn't really matter who I am, the voice said soothingly, and Tom realized now that it wasn't coming from either his own head or from beside his ear. It was coming from the balloon, from the center of that strange, lovely white light. All that matters is that I am going to see that everything turns out to your satisfaction, Tom. I want to see her take a weapon. I want to see them all take a weapon. They've crossed my path once too often, and much too late in the day for them. So listen, Tom, listen very carefully. All together now, follow the bouncing ball.
Tom listened. The voice from the balloon explained. It explained everything. When it was done, it popped in one final flash of light, and Tom began to dress. 2.
Audra.
Audra also had nightmares. She awoke with a start, sitting bolt upright in bed, the sheet pulled around her waist, her small breasts moving with her quick, agitated breathing. Like Tom's, her dreaming had been a jumbled, distressful experience. Like Tom, she had had the sensation of being someone else, or rather, of having her own consciousness deposited, and partially submerged, in another body and another mind. She had been in a dark place with a number of others around her, and she had been aware of an oppressive sensation of danger. They were going into the danger deliberately, and she wanted to scream at them to stop, to explain to her what was happening. But the person with whom she had merged seemed to know, and to believe it was necessary. She was also aware that they were being chased, and that their pursuers were catching up little by little. Bill had been in the dream, but his story about how he had forgotten his childhood must have been on her mind, because in her dream Bill was only a boy, 10 or 12 years old. He still had all his hair. She was holding his hand and was dimly aware that she loved him very much, and that her willingness to go on was based on the rock-solid belief that Bill would protect her and all of them, that Bill, Big Bill, would somehow bring them through this and back into the daylight again. Oh, but she was so terrified. They came to a branching of many tunnels, and Bill stood there, looking from one to the next, and one of the others, a boy with his arm in a cast, which glimmered a ghostly white in the darkness, spoke up.
That one, Bill, the bottom one.
You're sure?
Yes.
And so they had gone that way, and then there had been a door, a wee wooden door no more than 3 feet high, the sort of door you might see in a fairy tale book, and there had been a mark on the door. She could not remember what that mark had been, what strange rune or symbol, but it had brought all her terror to a focusing point, and she had yanked herself out of that other body, that girl's body, whoever.
Beverly.
She might have been. She awoke bolt upright in a strange bed, sweaty, wide-eyed, gasping as if she had just run a race. Her hands flew to her legs, half expecting to find them wet and cold with the water she had been walking through in her head. But she was dry. Disorientation followed. This was not their home in Topanga Canyon or the rented house in Fleet. It was no place. Limbo furnished with a bed, a dresser, 2 chairs, and a TV.
Oh, God, come on, Audra.
She scrubbed her hands viciously across her face, and that sickening feeling of mental vertigo receded. She was in Derry, Maine, where her husband had grown through a childhood he claimed no longer to remember. Not a familiar place to her, or a particularly good place by its feel, but at least a known place. She was here because Bill was here, and she would see him tomorrow at the Derry townhouse. Whatever terrible thing was wrong here, whatever those new scars on his hands meant, they would face it together. She would call him, tell him she was here, then join him. After that, well, actually she had no idea what came after that. The vertigo, that sense of being in a place that was really no place, was threatening again. When she was 19, she had done a whistle-stop tour with a scraggy little production company, 40 not-so-wonderful performances of Arsenic and Old Lace in 40 not-so-wonderful towns and small cities. All of this in 47 not-so-wonderful days. They began at the Peabody Dinner Theater in Massachusetts and ended at Play It Again, Sam, in Sausalito. And somewhere in between, in some Midwestern town like Ames, Iowa, or Grand Isle, Nebraska, or maybe Jubilee, North Dakota, she had awakened like this in the middle of the night, panicked by disorientation, unsure what town she was in, what day it was, or why she was wherever she was. Even her name seemed unreal to her. That feeling was back now. Her bad dreams had carried over into her waking, and she felt a nightmarish, free-floating terror. The town seemed to have wrapped itself around her like a python. She could sense it, and the feelings it produced were not good. She found herself wishing that she had heeded Freddie's advice and stayed away. Her mind fixed on Bill, grasping at the thought of him the way a drowning woman would grip at a spar, a life preserver, anything that... We all float down here, Audra. Floats. A chill raced through her, and she crisscrossed her arms across her naked breasts. She shivered and saw goosebumps ripple their way up her flesh. For a moment, it seemed to her that a voice had spoken aloud, but inside her head, as if there was an alien presence in there. Am I going crazy? God, is that it? No, her mind responded. It's just disorientation, jet lag, worry over your man. Nobody's talking inside your head. Nobody. We all float down here, Audra, a voice said from the bathroom. It was a real voice, real as houses. And sly, sly and dirty and evil. You float too. The voice uttered a fruity little giggle that dropped in pitch until it sounded like a clogged drain bubbling thickly. Audra cried out, then pressed her hands against her mouth. I didn't hear that. She said it out loud, daring the voice to contradict her. It didn't. The room was silent. Somewhere, far away, a train whistled in the night. Suddenly she needed Bill so badly that waiting until daylight seemed impossible. She was in a standardized motel room exactly like the other 39 units in the place, but suddenly it was too much, everything. When you started hearing voices, it was just too much, too creepy. She seemed to be slipping back into the nightmare she'd so lately escaped. She felt scared and terribly alone. It's worse than that, she thought. I feel dead. Her heart suddenly skipped two beats in her chest, making her gasp and utter a startled cough. She felt an instant of prison panic, claustrophobia inside her own body, and wondered if all this terror didn't have a stupidly ordinary physical root after all. Maybe she was going to have a heart attack, or was already having one. Her heart settled, but uneasily. Audra turned on the light by the bed table and looked at her watch. 3:12. He would be sleeping, but that didn't matter to her now. Nothing mattered except hearing his voice. She wanted to finish the night with him. If Bill was beside her, her clockwork would fall in sync with his and settle down. The nightmares would stay away. He sold nightmares to others. That was his trade. But to her, he had never given anything but peace. Outside that odd, cold nut embedded in his imagination, peace seemed to be all he was made for or meant for. She got the yellow pages, found the number for the Derry townhouse, and dialed it. Derry townhouse. Would you please ring Mr. Denbrough's room, Mr. William Denbrough? Does that guy ever get any calls in the daytime? The clerk said. And before she could think to ask what that was supposed to mean, he had plugged her call through. The phone burred once, twice, three times. She could imagine him sleeping with everything under the covers except the top of his head. She could imagine one hand coming out, feeling for the phone. She had seen him do it before, and a fond little smile touched her lips. It faded as the phone rang a fourth time, and a fifth, and a sixth. Halfway through the seventh ring, the connection was broken. That room does not answer. No shit, Sherlock, Audra said, more upset and frightened than ever. Are you sure you rang the right room? Yep, the clerk said. Mr. Denbrough had an inter-room call not 5 minutes ago. I know he answered that one because the light stayed on the switchboard a minute or two. He must have gone to the person's room.
Well, which room was it?
I don't remember. Sixth floor, I think.